Welcome. I'm glad to see people came. Did anybody show up last Tuesday when it was canceled? Good. Scott did. He got the email at the last minute that he was to come and help assist, and so he came and didn't have time to look online, and it was canceled for naught. But I guess it's better to be safe than sorry, especially after what happened Wednesday to people trying to get home from work. So did any of you get caught in the traffic on Wednesday? Oh, I'm sorry. It's bad. Yeah, we had two employees. One just pulled off the road and spent the night. I don't know how he did it, but anyhow, he was so afraid to get home. So we had a bigger class last session. I hope I didn't scare anybody off, but a lot of times this is what happens when you have those little breaks. So make sure you look at go online and look at the calendar, because we're going to have another break. To make up for the class last week, I had a choice of either skipping it or extending it. So I decided to extend it, but there is something scheduled on one of the Tuesdays. So there'll be a class the next 2 weeks. Scott's going to do next week because I'm out of town, and he's excellent. So y'all have a special opportunity to hear Scott. And then I'll be back for the next 2 weeks, but we will have a break in between. So look at the calendar for the exact dates. I didn't memorize what the dates were. So we're here for Buddhism in a Nutshell, Session 2, and I welcome all of you back. Who's here for the first time? Oh, lots of people here for the first time. Good. And did I hear you were from Ohio? He came all the way to Ohio to listen to this teaching. I'm so impressed. Oh, I bet you did, because you drove right through it, right? What brought you down here?
Well, actually, I came from Florida.
Okay, so he didn't fight the snow all the way. All right. Good. Well, if any of you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. I welcome you. We do have handouts online on the website, and one of them's back there that is just the welcome to Buddhism in a Nutshell. Did I say Discovering Buddhism before? I said Buddhism. Good. Because this is Buddhism in a Nutshell. So the welcome handout is back there. Feel free to pick one up. And then there's other handouts online as well. And then one I couldn't find online, so I think I'll make copies for the next time I teach, and I'll bring it, because it's a good handout, and I'll talk about that later. I do have my email address up there, and if you sat closer, you could read it. So you have to come up and get it off the board if you can't see it. But it's just mastriani.karen@gmail.com. And feel free to email me if you have questions, or I can get you information. I'm happy to do that. And we have several things on the agenda tonight. One, we're going to just do a quick review from our last session 2 weeks ago. Going to talk a little bit more about the history of Buddhism and how it spread throughout the world. Talk about the mind. Again, we mentioned it last time. We're going to go a little bit more this time, and then you'll continue to get more information on the mind in the upcoming sessions. We're going to talk about meditation, and we're going to practice meditation, obviously. And then we introduced the Four Noble Truths last time. And, the Four Noble Truths, like the mind and meditation, are pretty much the foundation of Buddhism. And so we will go into a little more detail on the Four Noble Truths. And again, all we're doing is skimming the surface of these topics, because they are very deep. And you can read to study more. We have classes here where you can learn more. The Discovering Buddhism classes spend 4 to 6 weeks on a topic that we're spending 20 to 30 minutes. So, if you get your feet wet and you decide you want to delve a little deeper, that's a good way to do it. But just coming on Sundays is a good way to get your feet wet and listen to our teacher, Geshe Gelug, talk, and their lovely teachings, open to the public, really, for all faiths and all walks of lives. It's good to come to those teachings as well. And we can talk a little bit more about that process and how that goes. So before we talk about any questions that came up or moving forward, let's go ahead and do a short meditation, and we'll set our intentions. And since since it's been 2 weeks and since we have lots of new folks in here this evening, we'll go through the sitting positions and the importance of learning that, at least in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And then we'll talk about intentions and dedication, because those are also two very important concepts in Tibetan Buddhism. So we have a 7-point meditation posture, and that handout is available online, so you don't have to worry about kind of memorizing anything. And after you do this, it really becomes, you just have it, you know, memorized, and it comes very naturally. But those of you, especially anybody who's practiced meditation in other traditions, you know there's different postures. So this is one more that you're learning. So in the 7-point posture, you can either be sitting on a chair or on a cushion. And I loved Geshe-la's teaching a couple weeks ago where he called the cushions comfort cushions. And there's nothing special about sitting on a cushion versus sitting in a chair. But it's nice to have a special spot, like in your home or somewhere where you know, that's my meditation cushion. That's my meditation chair. You know, it just kind of starts to set your intentions in that whole mindset. So now, once Geshe-la said that, I just think about this as my comfort cushion. And so you want to start with either your feet being flat on the floor. If you can't get them flat on the floor, you can grab a pillow and put them under your feet. And then if you're sitting, you want to be sitting on the cushion so that your backside is a little higher than your knees. It helps to strengthen your back. It also takes less pressure on your knees too. It's just a more comfortable position as well. But the goal is that you want to be open to energy and you want to have a nice straight back. So it's the posture that can do that. If you can sit in a full lotus position, like some can, great. If you can sit in a half lotus position, like some can, that's fine. You can also just sit Indian style, whatever's comfortable to you. And then your hands should be right hand in the palm of your left with your thumbs lightly touching. And then you want your shoulders relaxed, your arms relaxed. You want to hold your hands just relaxed below your navel with your elbows out a little way from your body. And the idea is for alertness and energy as well as airflow, so that if you're sitting for a long time, it's more comfortable to have more airflow. And then you want to relax your jaw and your mouth, so that your lips are lightly touching and your teeth are just lightly touching, just relaxed, nothing clenched. And then your tongue should rest at the top of your mouth, so that, and that again is to help that there's less saliva, so you don't drool when you get into deep meditation, and you don't have to swallow as much, so you don't have as many barriers or interruptions. And then your eyes should be slightly closed or slightly open is how they describe it. When you first start out, if doing that is too distracting, you can keep them closed. If you find you're getting drowsy, you do want to open them a little bit to let some light in. If your eyes are open, it's more distracting. So closed or just slightly open to let some light in. Your gaze should be looking downward, kind of like looking towards the tip of your nose, down towards the floor, but not looking at anything in particular. It's just a downward gaze. And your head, your chin should be slightly tilted. And the way it's taught is that if there was a string at the top of the crown of your head, that it's almost like a string pulling up, so that it keeps your spinal column, your back nice and straight, and your head slightly tilted down. And if you think of your spine as just stacks of coins or stacks of blocks, it's just a nice way to hold that position. And so, in this position, just take a couple of deep breaths, just to let go of any tension from the busy day. And then let's set our intentions. So despite bad weather last week and now having to catch up with everything that was shifted from your work schedule and your home schedule. You decided to fit this in and come for whatever reasons you had. Some maybe just curiosity, some starting a journey, a spiritual journey to try to find what's right for you. And some are just beginning this path, the Buddhist path. Whatever reason, it's all okay. And then we just ask that you stretch that intentions. And for now, it's just with a thought that you're doing this for your own well-being and the well-being of all other sentient beings. And with that intention, we're going to practice a focus meditation. And we'll just do this for 2 minutes. And I want you just to focus on your breath. And we'll focus on the breath by doing a counting meditation. So try to count to 21 without any interruptions, without following a train of thought. And each inhale and exhale counts as one. Getting to 21 doesn't matter. The importance of this meditation is that when a thought comes into your mind, that you notice it and that you don't follow it. And without judgment, without following the story, you just let it pass and come back to the breath. Even starting all over again at number one, if you don't remember what number you're on. So no matter what number you're on, really rejoice in your efforts as we try to stay focused on the breath, as you gently nudge your mind back to the object of your focus, and dedicate all that positive energy and your wish to be a benefit to your own well-being and the well-being of others. Were any of you able to try to practice the last couple of weeks, those who were here the first time? How's that going? Yeah, it was like, ooh, some good, some bad. Anybody have any specific questions or problems that they were dealing with, either trying to meditate or with the topic that we covered? A few questions came up last week, and I got a couple of emails. One of the questions was, you know, when we did the bare attention on your breath, where I said either concentrate at the tip of your nose or at the fall and rise of your stomach, why you don't follow the breath. And they kept wanting to follow the breath. And in some traditions, you do that. You follow the inhale and the exhale, and there's actually even, you know, some of the meditations that we do where you follow light, you let light in, and you exhale dark smoke. So we do that sometimes, but when you're doing the bare attention on the breath or the focus, the whole point is to teach your mind to focus, because that concentration meditation will help us then as we're trying to concentrate on other objects and as we're trying to analyze other teachings. We want to control our mind. There's a tanka out in the lobby, and these are all tankas at different aspects of the Buddhist mind. But there's a tanka of elephant and going up a path and a monkey. So in Tibetan Buddhism, you think of your mind as an elephant. It's wild, it's uncontrolled, it's, you know, you try to get your arms around it and you try to control it and, you know, it's going to do it at once. And you want to think of mindfulness as the rope tying the elephant to that post, and the post being whatever object you're concentrating on. So right now it's our breath. So that's what we're trying to do, is tame our mind, you know, tame that elephant of our mind. And it works. Those of you who've been practicing for a while know that you begin to get those glimmers of a little bit of control and a little bit of space before you react, even in everyday life. So it really is very beneficial on a practical level as well. So teach your mind that focus. And then somebody asked, and I just thought this was hilarious because I can remember asking the exact question, how can your mind have so many thoughts in between counting, yet you never lose count? And then we think, oh, that's mindfulness. And isn't it amazing? Like, one, oh, forgot to feed the dog. Two, you know, I wish I had more time to prepare. Three, just these whole stories. But rejoice that we're even noticing those thoughts between counting. That's huge. We go through everyday life not even seeing all those thoughts we have in our crazy mind. And so when we sit, you know, that craziness starts to settle and you realize, oh, that's me. and then you learn to stop those thoughts between the counting. So right now, notice them and just let them glide by. Just, you know, let them float by and let them go. No judgment, just gently nudge your mind back to the breath, which is our object right now. And then there was a question, and I don't think he's here, about His Holiness not being the political head of Tibet, and if that was because of the Chinese takeover. And so anyhow, I looked that up, and according to the Charter of Tibetans in Exile, I mean, His Holiness was technically still considered the political leader and the spiritual leader of the Tibetan people, even after all those years in exile. And it wasn't until 2011 that he did relinquish, you know, the political head, because Tibet now has a democratic, you know, government, and so it just seemed more appropriate. And I didn't realize, so I was actually glad he asked that question, is he really is reverting back to the role of Dalai Lama, so they weren't the head of, you know, the political state. They were only the spiritual leader before. So there was nothing unusual in him doing that. Any other questions that popped up for you? Okay. So with intentions and dedications, let me just a quick reminder of the importance of doing that. It's like bookends on anything you do. And when you set the intention, then you're focusing your awareness, you're making that commitment. It just kind of solidifies that action. And, you know, if you decide this is your path and you go on to take refuge in the what we call the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. If you take refuge, then you also will take vows. And even though, like one of the vows is not killing, and even though probably nobody in this room has killed anybody, we kill insects and bugs all the time. And even if you intentionally don't kill insects anymore, that you really try to save insects that are in your home, which can be a real challenge. And everybody here has all kinds of techniques, so just ask. We've learned them all. When you take that vow, it makes the merit greater because you took a vow not to kill, and then you really are committed to not kill. So it actually increases the merit when you set those intentions or those vows. So important to do. And then with dedication, how Venerable Amy Miller explains it, it's like putting a drop in a pool. It's just you're adding all that merit to all the other merit you've had and everybody else's merit so that it really does become much huger than the one small thing. I think of the story of the little kid on the beach, although I'm told the story's not true, but I like to think it is, where she was throwing the starfish back into the water and somebody said, you can't save them all. And she says, but I made the difference for that one. And so we're making a huge difference and we're pulling all our efforts to, you know, that can have more benefit. And rejoicing in our efforts, which really isn't our custom here. We will sit in negative stuff that happens to us or that we do forever. We'll wallow in regret and guilt, and we know that habit. But when something good happens, oh, it's nothing, or we don't even talk about it. And yet rejoicing, you create that habit of more positive. So it really does, you know, we're starting to switch our minds to that side of things. So when you dedicate and rejoice in your effort, even if you sit and you think, oh, well, that was a waste of time. Geshe-la calls it chicken meditation. I think, oh, my gosh, he's inside my head. But, you know, where you sit sometimes and you think, I wasn't even thinking of anything of value, you still tried. And so rejoice even in that effort of trying because that's huge. Okay. So if there's nothing else, a quick review. And so let me just say that these are taped, and you can listen to the tapes if you miss one. So those of you who weren't here 2 weeks ago, it's probably out here on the computer. And if you bring a flash drive, who's ever assisting can help you pull it off, or I'm happy to help pull it off. And Scott, who has taught this class several times, his teachings are still on there. So you might want to pull his off from the first session, but mine might be up there as well. And with that, I want to say that there is no error in the teachings. The teachings are perfect. So if there's any error or confusion, it's your unfortunate karma to have me as a teacher, and I will clarify for you. I'll get you more information, or you can ask anybody else here for clarification, but the teachings are perfect. So it's just maybe how I'm conveying it that could be have error in it or be, you know, cause mistakes or confusion. So we did talk about Buddha's life up until he became enlightened, and I'm just going to do a quick review because most of you probably have heard that story before anyhow, but he was a prince. He was born into a wealthy family in India 2,500 years ago, and his father wanted him to be king and take over the kingdom, and he lived a rich, full life. He had anything you could ever want, and they protected him so that he never saw suffering, he never had any discomforts, he had anything he could possibly want. But he was curious what was outside the palace walls, and when he explored, he saw suffering. A sick person, an elderly person, a corpse, he saw somebody die, or somebody dead, and mendicants, other ascetics at the time who seemed peaceful and calm to him, but he had no idea what suffering was until it was explained to him. So that when he went back into the palace, he was never satisfied after that. He wanted answers. He wanted to know what was the meaning of life. He wanted to prevent the suffering of his loved ones and himself as well as others in his kingdom. And so he left the palace and spent 6 years trying to find answers. And he studied primarily with five other monks at the time. And they tried all kinds of different techniques. And one was pretty severe, you know, austere living conditions where they didn't even eat except for, you know, a leaf or a grain of salt or a grain of rice. And it was at that point when he was so weak that he realized there had to be a middle way, that you couldn't have all the luxuries and you couldn't live that austere and find the answers. And it was the story of the musician who came by playing or the guitar and, you know, tuning it. And he realized that if the strings of the guitar were too loose, they didn't play well. And if they were too tight, it didn't play beautiful music. And so it was just that middle way that he found. So with that, he ate nourishment. He sat under the Bodhi tree for 49 days. And then until he reached enlightenment. So he was a person. He was a human being just like us, and he was able to eliminate all the obscurations, all the negativity in his mind, all non-virtuous thoughts and actions, and replace it with all virtuous thoughts and all virtuous states of mind. So does anybody remember what the definition of enlightenment is? Did you bring your notes from last? Oh, where's the magic mic? Did you bring your notes from last week? So let me say, when you talk, you need to talk into the mic. So I hope that doesn't make anybody afraid to talk. But people who are listening and people who are streaming won't hear your questions if you don't talk into the mic. And, you know, if we're just shouting things out, I'll try to repeat it. But if you have something lengthy to say, it's really good to talk into the mic, or else there's just this blank on the tape. So anybody remember, now that I pulled the mic out, nobody's going to say what the definition of enlightenment is, are you? Who wants to take charge of the mic and pass it around if anybody's going to ask a question? Here's the deal. I'll bring it back. Don't get up. Here's the deal. Don't make eye contact. Because then you're the lucky person. So, the definition of enlightenment. This is a quiet group. Probably it's a small group. There's safety in numbers. You feel like you're more anonymous. How I understand it is it's full awakening. It's, you know, achieving Buddhahood, that omniscient mind, that all-knowing mind is really what enlightenment is. And that's what, you know, the Buddha was able to achieve. And after he achieved enlightenment, he went on to teach for approximately 40 years. He was 80 years old when he died. And he gave 84,000 teachings, but they're really divided into the three turning of the wills, and they're called the turning of the will of Dharma. And Dharma means that that protection. So it's to protect us from suffering. And we usually think of Dharma as teachings because we're following these teachings to protect our mind from suffering. Do you remember what some of the virtuous states of mind were that you said? Oh, I could tell this is a tough crowd tonight. What are our virtuous states of mind? What would you think of as a positive state of mind?
Good and pure thoughts.
Good and pure thoughts.
Gratitude.
Hmm?
Gratitude.
Love. Kindness. Generosity. I mean, all those good things that we know. And the non-virtuous states of mind are pretty much the you know, the opposite: greed, jealousy, pride, anger, attachment, which we'll talk about attachment as well as being a non-virtuous state of mind, and we'll talk about that a little bit tonight. And the whole idea is that we have the capability of eliminating our minds of all those non-virtuous states and only having a mind of positive states. And in the Buddhist view, those positive states of mind are the natural state of mind. Like, that's our natural mind state, and that's truly what we want to keep developing and getting back to that root or that basic nature of our human mind, is that goodness. And that's what studying Buddhism helps us do. So Buddhism is looking inward. So it's looking in, it's studying the mind, it's becoming familiar with our own minds, and in that study it's realizing that happiness and suffering are actually caused within our own minds, within ourselves, and not external. So it's looking internal for those thoughts. Anything else that anybody has to add to those? Okay. So with the history of Buddhism, and we had a puja in here this evening, and a puja is a lovely ritual. This was a Medicine Buddha puja tonight, but I knew there wasn't going to be a lot of time for me to set up anything. But when we're going to look at the spread of Buddhism, and I'll put this map up here on how Buddhism spread throughout the world. But in his 40 years of teaching, and the Buddha's first teaching was at Deer Park. He went to find the original mendicants, the original monks that he had started this process with for 6 years. And he gave the first teaching, or the first turning of the wheel, which was the Four Noble Truths on suffering. And we'll talk more about that tonight. And he gave, in those 40-some years, 84,000 teachings. And these books up here, all along the altar, those are actually Tibetan, all the teachings of the Buddha are in all these books. And Geshe-la had these sent here several years ago and placed up on the altar. Not that any of us could read them. But they're all the Lam Rim teachings from the Buddha. And even though there's 84,000 teachings, there are no contradictions in his teachings. That, you know, he taught different teachings depending on what people were ready to hear, what they were capable of hearing, but it was all the same message that would be of benefit to our minds. Yes, you may. Oh, please. And interrupt any time. Feel free to ask questions whenever. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you do have to turn it on. You have to press it in, and then the light should be green. Perfect.
What was the teaching that the monks that inspired him were following?
Oh, I don't know if I heard anything specific. They tried different ones over the 6 years, and so a lot of it was just asking those big life questions, what is the meaning of life, and trying to sit and meditate on that, only they would do it through really austere methods. Like, they felt like if they ate food, then that would obscure the mind. So they were really trying to get to know the mind, is how I understand it, and they tried different ways to do it. So they didn't eat. They tried not sleeping. They tried to meditate for a while.
When he left the palace, he came across a monk, right,
that was peaceful and calm.
Exactly. So, I mean, I don't know. There was a teaching that monk was...
I don't know that I ever heard that there were any specific teachings. But that's a really good question. All I've ever heard were they tried different things and different teachings. And Scott's probably not listening. No. I'll ask. Hi, Scott. You know, a question just came up when the Siddhartha left the palace and he was trying different teachings with the other five mendicants. Did you ever hear what the specific teachings were they were trying to study and follow?
Thanks. Just so whoever's listening to the recording can hear. What I've heard about that is that Siddhartha studied with two separate teachers, and that he was mainly studying meditation practices. And again, there are a lot of different versions of the story too, but he's mainly studying different meditation practices, and that he basically learned everything he could from those two teachers and felt like he still hadn't found the answers he was looking for about, you know, the meaning of life, the meaning of suffering. And that's when he went and studied with the five monks that, you know, they were following the really austere, strict austerity practices, you know, the fasting, and felt that that was, you know, denying all sensory pleasure and you know, attachment was the way to find that. So that's the only thing that I'm familiar
okay.
with. Anything more specific than that, then no. Sorry.
But that's good. Thank you. And Scott will be teaching next week on karma and something else. I don't remember.
Karma, rebirth.
Oh, yeah, it is fun stuff. Karma and rebirth. Okay. But that really didn't help answer your question too much, but it was that searching. All right. So with the teachings, obviously, originally they were oral transmissions. And that remains really strong in this tradition. And it's that lineage is really important, so that, like, when you receive a teaching, even the teachings from His Holiness, he will say, and I received this teaching from Lama so-and-so, who received it from Lama so-and-so. I mean, they'll go back, you know, centuries on how this oral transmission came down. And if that lineage is ever broken, then it's lost until the next Buddha comes, or that, you know, that teaching is revitalized. And so keeping that lineage is still strong. Obviously, we rely on written materials, and incredibly, I mean, we have a bookstore full of translations in English so that we can read and follow these teachings. So we do have that value here. But the monks in India now, who are studying like a Geshe-la monastery, they memorize the text, so they can sit and they'll memorize hundreds of pages at a time. It's just such a phenomenal process. But I encourage you that when you find prayers that you like or teaching that you like, it's really important that we still practice that memorization technique, not just because it's good for our minds, but then wherever you are, you have it, and you'll be able to pull it up instantly without thinking, where's my prayer book? I don't remember the next line. I mean, we may not get it perfectly, but that memorization is still even important today. So good to know, and it does have a lot of advantages. And as these oral transmissions were being taught, Buddhism began to spread, and it's amazing how quickly it spread, like in probably the 500 BCs, I mean, all the way down to you know, AD, that the teaching spread. And of course, first in India, where it spread throughout India, and then into Sri Lanka, throughout Asia and Southeast Asia, China and Japan, and then it came into Tibet a little bit later than the other areas. And as it spread, you get different schools of Buddhism. So, you know, in Japan, it's a very strong Zen tradition, and so there's all kinds of different traditions that developed, including in Tibet. And each country had a little bit of different flavor, just because of the culture of the country kind of infused with the Buddhism. And in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, Tibet is a pretty sparse and barren land. It's, you know, a lot of snow and gray, and there's not a lot of flowers that bloom there, just some. And so the tradition became very colorful. So lots of colors, lots of prayer flags, lots of visual images kind of came in that Tibetan tradition. And so those are a very important part. And even in Tibet, so every country kind of has its own flavor of Buddhism. And then in Tibet, you actually have four main schools or sects or traditions that developed in Tibetan Buddhism. And I don't know if you can see those. I wrote them up here just so if you're interested in the spelling. But you have the Nyingma tradition, the Kagya tradition, the Sakya tradition, and the Gelug tradition. And the Gelug tradition is His Holiness the Dalai Lama's tradition, and that's the tradition that we follow here at our center. These are all Tibetan Buddhist schools. They're all very similar. There's not much differences between them. I don't know a lot, but I do know that His Holiness has teachers from all these other traditions. And I've been at teachings when, you know, those in the different traditions were sitting up, you know, with him as he gave his teachings. And so he feels that they all have a role and are vital. There's less differences there than there are similarities is the way I understand it. War has also influenced the spread of Buddhism, either hindering it by a lot of monasteries were destroyed during wars. A lot of monks weren't allowed to practice and still aren't in some countries. But it also increased the spread. Like His Holiness has even said, if the Chinese government hadn't taken over, you know, hadn't come into Tibet in the late 1950s, Tibetan Buddhism wouldn't have spread like it did. But because of that, of being forced out, it went back into India and then came here into the West. And so that's an incredible gift to us that came out of such a tragedy. Any questions about these? Oh, and he's got the mic back. So good. So you have the different schools, and then you have what are called different vehicles or yanas. Yana means vehicle in Tibetan Buddhism. And actually, I think I put these up here so that you would see these spellings as well. So you have the Hinayana, which means the traditional, or I guess the literal translation is like lesser vehicle, but it really, probably more accurately, it's the individual vehicle of studying Tibetan Buddhism. And then you have the Mahayana, which is our tradition. Literally, it's translated to be the greater vehicle, but probably a more correct or accurate translation is the universal vehicle of Tibetan Buddhism. And then the last one is Vajrayana or Theravada. And it's a more ritualistic type of Buddhism, and another people will call it tantric. So it's a different path. So the differences are, in the Hinayana tradition, you're looking for individual liberation or individual nirvana. So, you know, you practice just to relieve your own suffering. In the Mahayana tradition, it's, yes, you want to practice to eliminate your own suffering, but the suffering of all sentient beings. So it's a more altruistic, more encompassing kind of purpose or goal for why we're practicing. And then the Theravada, and some people, the symbol's like a lightning bolt, and it's like the quick, you know, a quicker path for those who can practice on that tantric level, and that ritualistic level. There's not a great rigid distinction between these. One isn't better than the other. They're just different levels. And you almost have to practice on all the levels as we're trying to, you know, rid our minds of non-virtuous thoughts, only leave the imprints of virtuous thoughts, and that we all become enlightened. Yes? These are all Tibetan Buddhist traditions. That's correct. They're vehicles. And even in, good question, and even in the Lam Rim, which is the path or the teaching, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Lam Rim tonight, and then we'll talk more over the next 3 weeks about the Lam Rim. But there's three levels within the Lam Rim. You have the small scope or the lesser scope, where it's talking about how do you get rid of suffering and, you know, wish for a better rebirth in our next lives. And then you have the middle scope, which is, no, I think the small scope is how do you eliminate sufferings. And then the middle scope is that wish for a greater rebirth. And then you have the large scope or the great scope, which is that benefit for all living beings. And so you even have those three different scopes within the Lam Rim as well. And all are valued. They don't really focus so much on one, it's the exclusivity as the other, and you don't really hear too much said about the differences or talk that much. So this is just more as a background and for your own benefit that you know that there's these different vehicles. Questions about the history? Oh, sorry.
So could you explain what exactly do you mean by vehicles?
Vehicle would be a path of study. Would be a good way. So a vehicle would be like how, what's going to take us on this journey. I guess what helps me, even when I study the Lam Rim, is there's value at all these levels. So if I want to, if the path that I've chosen is Hinayana, if that's the vehicle I'm in, then I'm only looking at how can I relieve my own suffering. What's going to help me do that? So what meditation techniques are there? What teachings are there to help me find liberation and nirvana and get rid of my suffering? Then if I want to broaden that and think, well, how can I get rid of my suffering when there's so much suffering around? If I can make that stretch, you know, there's we have a book out there on the 16 guidelines, but in there they tell a story. Actually, it's in Wise Heart too, but they tell a story of Desmond Tutu, who was touring with journalists, and when they would come up to people, and you know, in the West we say, "How are you?" And they'd ask people, "How are you?" And you know, Desmond Tutu would ask, and they would say, "We are fine. We are well. We're not good." And a journalist said to Desmond Tutu, what is this we bit? Why did they say we when you ask how somebody is?" And he said, "Well, how could they be well if their family member was ill, if their neighbor was ill?" So our well-being is directly tied to the well-being of others. When others suffer, it's directly tied to ours. And that Mahayana vehicle are meditations and practices we can do to keep making that stretch, keep encompassing other beings, you know, growing that compassion. So the vehicle would be the tool, I guess, would be a good way to look at it. And then the Theravada or the Vajrayana, that is the, those are tools for those that are ready that can, you know, give that quicker path, that be that quicker vehicle to find enlightenment. So they're vehicles to enlightenment. You know, and if you think about it, even if you think about the Lam Rim this way, if you wanted to take, if you wanted to go out to California to take a trip, you could get in your car and head west, and sooner or later you're going to hit California. But if you had a map or a GPS that said this is the quickest way, then you would maybe make a more direct target there. Or if you knew somebody who said, you know, "I just came back, and whatever you do, avoid such and such route because they're doing construction, and if you can go around it this way, the value in that." And so that's how I see these vehicles, is people who know how are they going to help us get to where I want to go, where we want to go to reach enlightenment. That help? Boy, if I'm, sometimes I listen to myself through this mic and I think, oh my gosh, I don't understand me. So if it ever doesn't make sense, please say, "Oh, wait a minute, start over," and I'll be happy to do that. All right. We're all good. Oh, I feel sorry for the people on the tape. But one of them is Dander, my friend's dog. Hi, Dander. I don't know if you're listening. Dander might be the only one that's getting this. All right. So we're going to do another meditation, and then we're going to talk about the mind a little bit and then the Four Noble Truths. But before we do the meditation, the Tibetan word for meditation is GOM, G-O-M, and it just means to become familiar, to be familiar. And so we are trying to become familiar with our minds, to recognize, you know, what our mind is and try to begin to control our thoughts, you know, tie that elephant to the post. And then we're also trying to familiarize our minds with positive and virtuous things. And the more we can do that, the more positive karma we can create, the better, especially if we can recognize the non-virtuous states and begin to stop those, to begin to control those. And so that's all we're doing when we meditate. There's nothing magical about meditation, but it's a valuable tool. So, and I've even heard Venerable Rabina say this, that, you know, she fought sitting, and I hear others say it, you fight sitting on a cushion because it's uncomfortable and you can't, and what all the excuses we have, we're too busy and you think I'll be mindful during the day. And that's great, but it would be like flying down a highway 100 miles an hour and thinking we're going to be able to be in control of that car. You know, it's just good to be able to sit and begin to see the mind, control the mind, even if it's just for a few minutes, and then practice throughout the day, because the practice throughout the day is what's going to cement it. So if we can do both, that's huge. That's where we want to go. But the value of sitting is really, really important. So, you know, try to keep trying to do that, even just a few minutes a day. And so all we're practicing right now is a very focused meditation. We're concentrating on an object, and our object is the breath. Always have it with you. It's a simple but powerful technique, and it will control the mind. You can look at a picture. You know, when you think of a loved one, you can almost pull their face up instantly. And so if we can do that with holy objects like this beautiful Buddha that we have on our altar, you know, to memorize that picture, all the features, the colors, and to be able to pull that picture up and focus our undivided attention on that for as long as we can, that's huge as well. So you can look at holy images. Doesn't just have to be the breath. There are elaborate visualizations, some for concentration meditation as well as even analytical meditations. You can do elaborate visualizations. The sand mandalas. I don't know if any of you came when the monks were just here a month or so ago doing the sand mandala, and that's a very powerful visual meditation that they do. Elaborate rooms and directions, and very lovely. So you can do those focus meditations, concentration, and then there's analytic meditations where you take a topic and you concentrate and drill down on that topic. We need to have the focus and the concentration to be able to concentrate on certain topics. So both meditations are good and powerful. Somebody once asked, I think, I don't remember what teacher they asked, but they said, I think it was Venerable Rene when he was here, because he was really having us do focus meditations for, who was here for Venerable Rene's teaching? Did you go, Jeffrey? I mean, we were in here for a couple of hours. Really, it was wonderful. And so they asked him, like, do we have to nail this focus meditation before we can do analytical? He says, oh, you'll never do analytical. You know, you kind of have to balance it out. And so you practice the focus, and then you try doing some analytical, and then go back to the focus. But the more focus and concentration we can get, the better. So with that being said, unless you have any questions about meditations or how or reasons. So let's go ahead and sit and settle our minds, and we'll do a bare attention on our breath meditation. You can count if you want, if that helps you with your bare attention, but try either just focusing your attention at the tip of your nose to feel the air going in and out, and just concentrate on that tip of your nose in that air as if that's all that mattered and your life depended on it. If it's easier for you to just feel your abdomen, you know, rise and fall, like think of it like an ocean on a wave, that rise and fall of the waves, concentrate there. Don't follow your breath, just stay one or the other, at your nose or your, you know, the rise and fall of your abdomen. So sit in the 7-point posture, feet flat on the floor, back straight so you don't lean too far into your chair. If you're on your cushion, comfortable position, back straight, right hand in the palm of your left, with thumbs lightly touching, just below your navel. Your shoulders and your arms should be relaxed. Your elbows out a little bit. Mouth lightly closed, but jaw relaxed. Tongue at the roof of your mouth. Eyes slightly open or mostly closed, with your chin just slightly tilted down as if you have a string pulling from the crown of your head and pulling that stack of blocks or coins nice and straight. And focus your bare attention on your breath. Our mind will wander. We'll hear things. Something will interrupt us. We'll chase a piece of dust in front of our eyes. And just gently keep pulling the mind back to the object of your focus. to dedicate any positive energy from sitting and concentrating on the breath. Takes great effort to focus like this. You're not trying to think nothing. You will fail. You want to think of the breath, the object of your meditation, and just trying to not follow the thoughts, not let your thoughts be in control of your mind. Make sense? Simple exercise and meditation, not easy to do, and extremely powerful. And so we talked a little bit about the mind. Any questions or issues that popped up? I'll tell you what popped up for me, and I kept trying to let it go. And so here's another thing that I do at my little meditation table at home. I keep a little notepad. So when there's a thought that I can just not let go of, and then I'm afraid I'm going to forget it, so you just think, I'm going to forget it. I just have a little notebook, and I write it down. Put my pen down, let it go, and stop. The goal is that you don't even have to do that. But while we're practicing, that can be very helpful. But I kept thinking of vehicle, and it's just a guide, a path, a teaching to get us there. Might be clearer. Anything else pop up for anybody else? All right. So the mind in Tibetan Buddhism, and Buddhism is all about the mind. And so when we think of the mind, it's consciousness. It's the mind is awareness. It's not being aware. It is aware. It's just all knowing. In our mind, it's not physical. It has no shape, form, color. It's not the brain. They work in tandem together, and one needs the other. But you know, when you listen to Geshe-la or any of the monks talk about the mind, this is where they hit. We go our mind, but it's their heart mind. Like they'll hit here, and Western scientists continue to look for where is the mind, and so that's often an issue. So it has no form, it can't come from a physical, it is non-physical. And it's described as clear and luminous. And so it's just this clear, luminous, all-knowing consciousness, awareness. Our minds are clouded, especially on this growth level, with all kinds of delusions and obscurations and negative thoughts. But those are considered not part of the mind. That if we can start controlling those and letting those go, like the Buddha did, and like we are all capable of, then we can reach that clear, all-knowing luminosity that is just described as this complete bliss, is how you often, how you hear it described. So if you think of the mind, if you think of it as a mirror, and the mirror is, it's clear, it's reflective, but it can get grungy. You have to use, cleaner on it to clean off the grunge. Every time I clean my mirror, I think, okay, cleaning my mind. And then you know it's going to get filled up again, and then you're going to clean your mind again. So that's a good way to look at it. You can think of a lake. You have a beautiful, clear lake, and it may reflect the sky. It may reflect clouds. It may reflect trees. They're not part of the lake. They're reflections on the lake. They're there, but they're not part of the lake. The lake is that clear water, depending where you are, clear water. And the obscurations, even if there was poison in water, and you drank poisonous water and it would make you sick or kill you, that poison, if you had the technique and the scientific ability, you could separate out even the poison from the water. So all of these obscurations that we currently have in our mind, they're considered to be adventitious. They're external. They're not internal to our minds. And that we can, because they're adventitious, we can separate those out of our minds and get to that clear, all-knowing spaciousness or consciousness, conscious awareness, which is our mind. You can use those terms, you know, they're synonyms for what the mind is in Tibetan Buddhism. Make sense? Any questions about the mind? Have you heard this before? Does this make sense? You had it before. So what do we think of when we think of the mind in the West?
Brain.
The brain. That's the first thing we think of, our brain. Because that's where we think all our thoughts are. But the brain is physical. Now, the mind needs the brain to whatever, process things and all those neurons. They're closely interconnected, but they're not the same. Interesting. NPR on Sunday was doing a special on when they were first studying where does life come from. It was on Radiolab. I forget what time it's on. Anybody hear it? I missed it. But originally, when they were looking at where does life come from, they had sperm in a jar, and it was moving, and they said, it's moving, that's life, that's consciousness. And if we can study that, we're going to see a little picture of a man or woman, because that's where consciousness has to be, and that's where these little people are. And, of course, they never found that. And we've continued to be searching even today is where is that mind? Where does this come from? And Scott will get into more. We'll actually be talking about that next week when he talks about the continuity of mind and rebirth. And in Tibetan Buddhism, it's not just one consciousness or mind. Like we have, you know, the mind uses the brain, and we have all these senses that take in information for our mind. So with these senses, you have, you know, your eye, your nose for smell, ears for sound, taste, touch, and then you have a mental consciousness. And Tibetan Buddhists describe these as different consciousness. So you have an eye consciousness that, you know, all your eyes do is see an object. So they see form and color. And then you have sound consciousness, which just takes in whatever. I should know this, but the electrical stimulation, and we hear a sound. So your ears are just, you know, just that ear consciousness just takes in that information. Same with taste and touch. And then your mental consciousness and then your mind cognizes that object. So your eyes hear, your ears either hear something or your eyes see something, and your mind cognizes that, you know, that sight. And it will make it cognizes that object. It'll make an imprint of that object in our mind stream. And then your mental consciousness throws all the emotion or the thoughts onto that. So instantaneously, I see that maroon pillow, and I can't just say maroon, round, color, shape. It's a maroon cushion, and it looks comfortable, and I like that color of maroon, and we add all those things on it that aren't part of that, whatever our eyes just saw in that object or our mind cognized. We add all the stories and the colors and the dramas, and we either add the pleasantness, the unpleasantness, or neutral. So we either think, oh, that's a really good thing, or that's a really bad thing, and I'm going to go away from it, or I don't have any opinion. It's just there, and you don't think of it. And those are really the only three emotions or responses. Now, we get much more elaborate in our emotions and our responses to that, but that's pretty much all that happens once we cognize that object. Cognition of objects is not any different in Tibetan Buddhism than it is in Western psychology. I studied at NC State a few years ago, and in the College of Education, I mean, it was all about cognizing informations and objects. I mean, it's the same language used in other sciences, not just in the science of Buddhism, and how we perceive objects and what we think of it. So if we see a cake, a chocolate cake, we don't just see a chocolate blob sitting on a plate. We automatically see chocolate cake. And if it's my mind, I think, oh, chocolate cake. And you know what it's going to taste like. You can taste it before you even take a bite. I have a cousin who, like, hates chocolate. Like, just the sight of chocolate is revolting to her. I can't even cognize that mind, and she can't cognize why somebody would like chocolate cake. So it's just kind of interesting. So the reactions, it's not inherent in that object. It's, you know, our karma and our mind streams that either add that pleasantness, unpleasantness, or neutrality to whatever it is that we've cognized. Make sense? Okay. So fortunately for us, and that's the whole point of what we're studying and what we're doing, is that we can change our minds. And changing our mind will change our brain structure, which is kind of fascinating in neuroscience now. But we know if we can keep changing these habits, that we can strengthen neurons and synapses in our brains that will make those habits, will cement them, and that's where our mind will naturally go. So if your mind naturally goes to anger right now, and that's your response when you get upset, which is very common in most of us, that if we can control that anger and keep, you know, relaxing and practicing patience and kindness, we can actually strengthen those habits, that our brain and neurons will actually reconfigure so that that can become a normal response instead of anger. And that's true with any habits. We can see it so naturally with physical habits. We can see that if we want to learn how to play piano, we have to practice. You have to practice the scales. You have to practice basics. You have to make lots of mistakes. You have to be willing to do it for hours and hours. And when you nail it, you will play beautiful music, and you'll play beautiful music for years. We see it in sports. Michael Jordan wasn't a famous basketball player when, you know, he was growing up. He learned, he practiced, he failed more than he succeeded. He kept trying again, and then he became one of the greatest basketball guests. I don't know that much basketball, but one of the greatest basketball players there was. And that took practice. So we know that's what it takes, and you can actually change and build those skills. They don't come naturally. We build them. We can do the same thing with our minds. We can change our mind streams, and we can change, you know, we can actually create a physical, you know, changes with our mind by doing that. Yes. Yeah. If you don't mind, I'll repeat a question. That's why I gave him the mic, so I don't have to get up. I'm pitiful when I get up after sitting for too long. Go ahead.
So suppose you practice meditation and train your mind to first react with patience and kindness instead of anger. So however many months or years that might take, your structure of your brain changes. So I didn't know that. But then can you stop? Because you said now your normal reaction, your go-to reaction will be the patience because you've just changed it. Or is it still hard work to the end of your life through meditation? And you know what I'm saying? Once I've practiced piano and I can play this piece I like,
you still have to practice,
piano metaphor,
right?
You still have to practice.
You still have to practice.
But I didn't, like, grow parts of my brain to make me play the piano.
Yes, you did. We just don't realize it, but you did grow parts of your brain. Go ahead. Do you have something to say?
You still have to practice, right?
You still have to practice.
You do, but you're breaking one neuron and reconnecting a new neuron. So just like when you learn to move your pinky further down the piano keys, that was teaching it that new firing in your brain. And if I get it wrong, but
it's perfect.
So your practice is less about having a new automatic response. It's about being a choice. So the practice becomes you get further and further away from these things you're learning. So then you, once you learn it, then you can choose it at more easily. It's not automatic anymore. Actually, it's choice. And in the past, not being able to do it was an automatic, I'm messing up. And then as soon as you learned it, then you can either choose to do it or not do it. And so meditation will help you get further and further away from any stimulus so that you can be at choice of how you want to respond, responsibility, ability to respond.
Yeah, perfect.
Does that help?
With, do people ever get so far with meditation and whatever, they just stop?
Yes, that you can be able to completely stop anger, pride, jealousy.
No, stop practicing meditation.
I don't know anybody who's ever stopped practicing until they've become a Buddha and they're enlightened, because you can always grow and learn more. And for a while, you're just, while you're trying to strengthen one neuron and break the other, you're just weakening it. So you're weakening that habit, which can take us eons of lifetimes. We may not nail it in this lifetime, but as long as we keep practicing it. And I can tell you, as somebody who I have said it, I have the right to be angry. I've earned this to be angry, and you cannot take it away from me. And I would just stick to that no matter what. And anger was kind of a natural response, and you actually forget that that was a natural response. So you can keep weakening it. Oh, don't have anything else.
I thought it was interesting in the beginning of the
class. Yeah, thank you.
At the beginning of the class, you said that in Buddhism, there's a belief that that is actually our natural state.
Yes,
but
we don't think that, do we?
But it seems as if we're constantly fighting our natural state. I mean, you just said anger is natural. So I wonder where that belief, well, to all of us, I wonder where that belief comes from, that it almost seems like we're constantly meditating and working towards this goal of overcoming our natural state, but yet...
And then we're reborn and we have to start over.
But the Buddhist belief is that... So what are we fighting? What is the Buddhist belief as... what's the great obstacle, I guess?
Okay. So actually, we're going to talk about some of that tonight, and then you're going to actually get into more of that in the upcoming weeks, but... We're so used to this gross mind and this anger, attachment, pride that seems like our natural state. And yet it's truly not. It's that goodness and that positiveness that from eons of past karma in past lives, which you'll learn about next week, that we've gotten those tendencies and those habits that are now just kind of, that's our hardwire until we begin to change it. And so we will talk about that now, especially when we talk about the truth of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering. Oh boy, good thing I don't read my notes too often because they're wrong. And then the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering are the Four Noble Truths. And the first point is, kind of to your point, is we have to first admit that we have an issue, a problem, or that we're suffering. It's kind of like an alcoholic. The first step is, I am an alcoholic. And then you're able to seek help and know what the help is. And just like in Buddhism, there's no contraindication to the teachings, and yet there's 84,000 teachings. That help can be different for all of us, depending on what stage we're in or what help. You know, what help we need, but that there is help. Most of us now, we get the suffering, like we get pain and heartbreak and losing jobs and hating our jobs and, you know, all the things that happen in life, and we kind of self-medicate. Like we do things that will temporarily help us feel better. It doesn't last, especially because most of what we search for is external. I mean, they even have names. You know, you have shopping therapy. 911, the president said, go out and buy something. Go out and shop. That's how we're going to recover and feel better. And that's what we do. You know, you shop to feel better. You think, you know, if I buy the new iPhone, I'll feel better. And then, you know, I buy the iPhone 4 and it's obsolete when I buy it. The iPhone 5 is out. So everybody's got the newest, latest, greatest gadget and I don't have it. So we can see the temporariness of most of the things that we seek to alleviate our suffering. But usually we still go after it. We kind of fluctuate between that. I'm happy and I have everything I want, and or I'll never be happy until I get the latest, greatest thing, and then, oh, woe is me. You know, I'll never be happy again because now I lost the latest, greatest thing. And then we go get the latest. You know, so we're constantly on that circle and that cycle of trying to alleviate the suffering that we have. Where the Buddha would say, we have to look internal and get rid of the suffering on the inside. That's what's going to make the difference, that the suffering is inside of us. So when you look at the truth of suffering and why we suffer, there's three types of suffering. You have the suffering, the suffering of change, and all pervasive suffering, or compounded suffering is what it's called. And suffering of suffering is what we know very well. It's you know, the headaches, the pains, the, you know, all the, you know, the suffering that we truly have. Now, we add suffering to that. So we can't just, you know, fall and skin our knees. It's like, oh, I can't believe I fell. You know, we add all this suffering on top of that suffering. But it's all life's discomforts, traumas that we have. And everybody gets that suffering. So that when you have it, you don't question, is this suffering? Or, you know, I mean, we all know that suffering. And then the next two levels of suffering are a little subtler. So you have the suffering of change, which means nothing, none of these external phenomena will last. That when we're happy or comfortable, we don't think that we're suffering anymore. We don't even think about suffering anymore. And we don't even realize when it starts to change. We think that it's going to last forever, but it will change. No matter how pleasurable something is, that pleasure will not last. So even with chocolate cake, when you eat that first bite of chocolate cake, it's incredible. And maybe even after three or four bites, maybe you could eat the whole piece. But if you ate the whole cake, it wouldn't be a pleasurable feeling anymore. Like, we know it would make us sick. If not sick immediately, eventually it would make us sick. If you kept eating chocolate cake because chocolate cake was pleasure, you know you'd be sick. Sitting in here, or actually think about sitting on a beach, and you're laying on the beach, and it's hot, and it's warm, and it feels so good in the sun. Then you get too hot, so you go in the water because you want to cool off. And then you get chilled, so you go get out of the water to go back in the sun, and you got to put a blanket over you, and then you got to take the blanket off because you're hot. Like on a, you know, we get this on some sense that, we, you know, things constantly change. What we think of pleasurable in this moment is not pleasurable in the next moment. It changes, and that's the suffering of change. You buy a shiny new car. I forget what a new car smells like, but you know that smell, and you just think, ah, you know, you're going to wash it and wax it every day, and then, you know, pretty soon it's leaking oil in your driveway, and it breaks down, and it's scratched, and you're tired of washing it, and it's dirty, and, you know, even that doesn't last. Like, kind of those are all examples of suffering of change. Even relationships. You have the love of your life. Everything's going along great. And then all of a sudden, you know, the way they cough or the way they snore at night, or, you know, things just start getting on your nerves. And that even changes. It's not all pleasantness all the time. And then the last one is all pervasive or compounded suffering. And that's even subtler. And that's just because it's just part of this cyclic existence. Just the fact, it's kind of what your question was, just the fact that we're here and we have all this karmic baggage from past actions and past lives that we bring into this cycle. And it's just kind of compounded and part of human existence. And one of Venerable Amy's tapas, she said, I mean, just look at our bodies. Like, our bodies are suffering. They're frail. They get old. They get sick. They do obnoxious things that aren't very pleasant to think about. And she said, yet we drive around 2-ton cars and we think that when we wreck them, that our bodies are going to survive over the car. And, you know, she says, no, metal and strength is going to win. Our, you know, our bodies are even just kind of fragile being part of this life. And that's, you know, kind of that karmic cyclic existence is that pervasive suffering. If that doesn't help you think about suffering, you know, the suffering is suffering, the suffering is, because when we're happy, we're not thinking we're suffering. Most, our minds don't even go there. So that suffering of change is just like, oh yeah, well, tomorrow, but today it's good, and this, I'm going to make it last forever. And then the compounded suffering. But another way to look at it is there's 8 types of suffering. So you can have either have 3, which for me, I can remember 3, or you can have 8. And the 8 types of suffering are birth, that just by being born and, you know, when you think about the whole babies in the womb and the whole birth process, very traumatic. And from the second that baby is conceived and comes out of the womb, it's already getting older and on the path to dying. I say that as I think about my beautiful little grandson who's only 3 months old. And then you have old age, and we're all going to get old. I don't know anybody that stayed young. We pay a lot of money trying, but it's not working for most people. But we continue to pay a lot of money. We get ill. We will die. There's nobody, no matter how rich, that won't die. I read the obituaries every morning. Sounds obnoxious. But I read them and I look at the age and I think, ah, yes, you know, 40, 45, 60. You know, you start thinking, okay, younger than me, baby, child, anybody can die, anybody can die. I could die today. You know, just can always be a good practice. And we'll be talking about death and death meditations, but just to remember, we will die. And that's part of life, and that can bring suffering to us. When we encounter something unpleasant, when we're separated from something that is pleasant, when we don't get what we want, when we're separated from loved ones, and we will be separated from loved ones. I mean, this is what the Buddha realized and thought he just had to do something. No matter how much you love somebody, it's going to end one day. Hopefully for most of us, not for a long time, but it could be today or it could be tomorrow. Not getting what you want, and then just suffering created by delusion and karma. And that should be 8 or close to 8. And so there's different ways to look at them, you know, at these different kinds of sufferings. So then the truth of the cause of sufferings. So awareness first, knowing we're suffering, even when we're happy. Even if you could look at somebody who's got everything they ever wanted, beautiful, rich movie star who has everything they want, and be able to see suffering, that's huge. That's where we want our minds to go and to be able to see. And then you need to look at what's the cause of suffering. Is it because I don't have enough money? I didn't get that nice job? My girlfriend, boyfriend, partner left me? You know, all the things that happen in our lives. If we got those things back, would that make us happy? Or what is that real cause of suffering? And most of us do tend to look at those external causes. But if we can look internal and see what those causes are. And Venerable Amy was talking, and she said that they were offering this whole class on Four Noble Truths, and nobody was coming. And she said next door to them at this conference building, they were, I forget what it was, something on finding love and happiness for life, and like they were like packed. Like their talk was free, and this, they were charging thousands of dollars, and it was packed. And Amy said, nobody wants to learn about suffering, but we can't be happy truly until we do, to find out what is real lasting happiness, what is real lasting suffering. Hopefully it won't last. That's a good thing, because suffering changes too. We all act like, when we're suffering that it's going to last forever, and it will change just like when we're not suffering, when we're happy does. So when you look at the cause of suffering, it's easy to realize it's internal, not external. If you look at His Holiness, who smiles and is a genuinely happy person, despite the great suffering of the Tibetan people that he witnessed firsthand, and yet, you know, he's able to think of the Chinese government as his teachers, and he loves the Chinese people and culture, and there's just no ill feelings or anger there whatsoever. He was giving a teaching in Pennsylvania. It was a week-long teaching that I was fortunate enough to go to, and they were protesting outside, and it was really disturbing. I mean, horrible things they were saying about His Holiness. And somebody finally asked about it in the teaching. He says, "Oh, you mean all those people out there shouting that we were all getting all worked up about?" He says, "Oh, I feel so sorry for them that they're gonna lose their voice." And he said, "And I hope they have enough to eat and they're protected from the sun." Like, that's where his mind went. Well, we're like, "Ooh, gosh, you can't move this thing. How dare they say that about His Holiness?" And, you know, where his mind automatically goes to that pleasant place. So we know it's not external. We know we don't all react the same to things. And so it's looking at that internal cause for what is the cause of suffering and happiness and being able to go there. Even in disasters, we see it, where people who lose everything they had, I mean, you know, the hurricanes that just happened, and you hear people just bemoaning they lost their house and all their belongings, and your heart just breaks, and you hear somebody else, you know, same news report, house devastated, and yet they can say, "I lost my house, but I have my health. Nobody in my family was hurt. My dog survived." You know, they kind of look at that different side of things. So you know it's not inherent in the suffering that's out there. It's really how we perceive it and how we react to it. And what are considered the six causes, and then because we're almost out of time, I am going to let Scott continue with this next week. But when you look at what the six roots or the main afflictions, the main causes of suffering are ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, doubt, and wrong view, where ignorance is considered really the root of all suffering, and it's just because we don't have a good understanding of what reality is and the way we look at reality. Attachment is, we kind of see as a good thing to be attached, and we don't realize that the negativity of being too attached, it doesn't mean not having joy or pleasure, but being able to let go and not remaining too attached. Pride is this grasping at self and thinking that we are the most important, you know, that self-cherishing ego that we have to protect ourselves, even at the risk of harming others sometimes, and that's considered one of the root afflictions. Doubt, where we doubt kind of what is true, especially in related to our ability to grow and just the preciousness of this human existence, that especially in the West, doubting that is very common. And Scott will get more into that next week. And then wrong view, just not being able to see the way phenomenon truly exists, the way reality is out there. And then just know that there is a way, the path is the way for the cessation of suffering. The Lam Rim path is really the main path that we take in Tibetan Buddhism to end suffering. So it is now 8:34. Scott will have the notes that we left off on to continue with the principal aspects of the path, that truth of the path to the cessation of suffering, and talk about that next week, as well as karma and rebirth, which will be topics for next week. And just realize that we can keep practicing, that part of this path is meditating, learning teaching, studying, practicing. We all practice good behaviors, those positive virtues, and just practicing those more. The more we can practice virtuous thoughts, virtuous behaviors, and keep those virtuous thoughts in our mind, the more that we can keep making those imprints and changing those neurons in our brains, making those stronger connections to that, to those virtuous actions and thoughts. Any questions before we end and dedicate?
I have a couple. Just when you are meditating, or when I am meditating, I've noticed I hear a humming, and the more I meditate, the louder it gets. What is that?
Okay, I don't know if y'all could hear. When she meditates, she hears a humming, and the more she meditates, the louder it gets. And there could be a physical reason for that humming, and when you're quieting your mind, then you hear it and become more aware of it. So it might not have anything to do with the meditation, but just in quieting the mind, like I have it, it's called tinnitus, I have it constantly. And some people that, it's not tinnitus, okay?
I can feel it in the back of my spine. I can feel it in my body. It is not a ringing in the ear.
It's not ringing in the ear. It's more physical.
No.
Hmm.
But I've read about it. So I was, and some of the monks said that they can feel a humming going, you know, from here and all the way down their back.
It could be something with an energy path and the way the energy is traveling, maybe. I don't know. It's a good question, and I'll look that up, and maybe, and I'll give Scott some information for next week. What was your other question?
I looked it up, and I only found very. I tried to Google it, and I didn't find a whole lot.
And I can ask Geshe-la as well, so we'll get it from straight from the expert.
Okay. Next question. Only once when I was meditating, I had like this vision that this door just popped up, and then it opened up, and there's this beautiful sky in it, and then the star went across, like a galaxy, this way. And then it went down like a slide projector screen. And then another one came up, and it had all this computer programming language on it. It's what I do. I don't program, but I work with computer stuff. And I was hunting for a job, so I knew when I saw that, that the job was on the way. And then the screen went down, and then it came back up, and I had a vision of, like, one of my friends telling me something. But I've only experienced that once. So is that like a dream, or?
It could be. It could be. You know, when we meditate, you know, you have different levels of consciousness or mind, from the gross level to the subconscious or the subtler level, and then the very subtle level. So a lot of times when we're letting go of that gross level of mind that we do when we're meditating, sometimes the subconscious can bubble up, and we have different intuitive reactions to that and feelings, so it could have been that. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's all kinds of symbolism of doors, and so it could even be something more to that. But I don't know. Who knows?
No, I just felt it didn't seem like a dream just because of the way it.
And you were awake,
and
so
I was,
you know.
And then later that same night, I was just laying down to go to sleep, and another thing just popped up, went away, and I know I wasn't dreaming. And I wasn't meditating,
it was probably an intuitive reaction to something, which is very interesting. And letting, you know, when you let the gross level of mind and the subconscious level. And it could be a good thing, and it maybe is not a good thing. So maybe if it doesn't happen again, who knows? Who knows?
Oh, it will. It's on the way.
Yeah. Listen to those intuitive feelings. They can be very important. And if anybody has any other questions or you want to talk about it further, I'm happy to stay. But just so we can end this and let everybody get on the road safely, since we're a few minutes late, just take a minute, close your eyes for a second, and just let go of any stresses or strains that you're feeling right now, any tenseness. You came here with the intentions of exploring and learning a little bit more about Buddhism. And every time you come to this class, you open a little bit more, you open a little bit more. We'll always build on that. We'll continue to build on that over the next three sessions, which will actually be over 4 weeks. Dedicate any positive merit that you've gained from being here tonight and your efforts to get here to your own well-being on this path to enlightenment, as well as the well-being and Buddhahood of all sentient beings. And maybe think of that just as your goal, that as you achieve enlightenment, you're going to bring all the rest of us all along with you, and that's your mission in life. And dedicate that mission that this will happen. Thank you very much. Scott will be here with you next week, so I'm glad you all had a chance to meet him. And then I'll see you in 2 weeks.